You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
Hey, this is Chris Webster jumping in right before the show. You are listening to a recording of a live broadcast that I did with Richie Cruz on KNVC 95.1 Carson Community Media. You can listen live every Friday, or sometimes we have it recorded, but most of the time you can listen live at knvc.org/listen-live. Now onto the show. You're listening to the Archaeology Show with Chris Webster. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and answers to your questions. Welcome to the show. All right. Hey, everybody. Chris Webster here from the Archaeology Show. And I'm down here in Carson City at KNVC 95.1 FM, Carson City Community Media. And this is a call-in show, of course, as I've said in the past, and I've got an in-studio guest who I'll introduce in a minute. But in the meantime, feel free to call at any point in time with literally any question about archaeology. I mean, we will not discriminate. Hey, jumping back in with my editing hat on for a second. Do not call in. Of course, this is recorded, but I mentioned the phone number several times throughout the show. So again, if you want to listen live, go to knvc.org/listen-live. Then you can call in. Back to the show. 775-515-4141. And you can hit us up on the socials too, at ArchPodNet or at Archeowebby, ArchEowebby. And when my guest is giving his intro, I'll make sure I pull the Twitter feed up because I forgot to do that. But we're going to talk about, as something I've talked about here in the past, when I first started broadcasting here in December, I keep mentioning I'm a CRM archaeologist or cultural resource management archaeologist. And in fact, I had somebody who doesn't know anything about archaeology or this whole field look at my profile at some point on something and say, CRM archaeologist, does he do the history of like customer resource management systems? Like, does he do the history of Salesforce? And I was like, no. So it's good to define these things. So that other person you hear on the line right now, that is Richie Cruz, and he's been a friend of mine probably since I got to Reno.
Yeah.
And in some of our first projects here, and we've worked together on projects. He's worked for me at my company. We're about to go out on an archaeology project here in March together down in Southern California, and we've just done a lot of things. Richie and I also have a Facebook live show. If you go over to facebook.com/archpodnet, ArchPodNet, you can follow that page because our Facebook live show is basically dependent on Richie and my schedule of being in town. So there's no regularity to it whatsoever. That's a traveling field archaeologist, which is what we're going to talk about. But for now, welcome to the show, Richie.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yeah, so he's down here in the studio. It's my first in-studio guest, so that's really fun. We don't have to deal with phones or anything like that. But I will deal with the phones when you call. Let me get that unit down here. So, Richie, why don't you tell us real quick a brief history of Richie Cruz, you know, where you're from, where you went to school, stuff like that.
Oh, well, let's see. I'm actually from the Bay Area, San Francisco Bay Area. I am from Alameda, used to be home of the Enterprise.
Yes. My dad, when he was on the Enterprise, got on in Alameda.
Yeah.
But when I was on the Enterprise, it was in Norfolk, Virginia.
Yeah, that's where they moved it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and of course, if you watch Star Trek IV.
Yes, where they keep the naval vessels.
And amazingly enough, I went to school at California State University, San Francisco State.
Nice.
Which means that I probably wasn't supposed to end up in CRM archaeology, but I did. And I'm even joking. That school actually did not have enough credits that if you wanted to graduate with a master's degree in archaeology, it technically didn't have enough credits for it.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Okay. Because, it's a long story, but it's very political.
Yeah. Well, we won't get into politics on this show.
What?
Plenty of other shows here on the network that get into politics.
Yeah, so. We might be more popular that way.
maybe. So how did you get your first job in cultural resource management?
Let's see. Well, first off, I went to field school and found out about cultural resource management, and then I realized I need a job. Which was not easy since I graduated in, 2008?
Yeah.
So, and unlike some other people I've read about, I realized it was going to be a tough job market. So I started sending out all my resumes right away and didn't get any bites for a long time until the Ruby Pipeline came along.
Wow, the Ruby Pipeline. Some people here in Nevada might be at least familiar with that. They probably was a lot of stuff in the news. I was just moving here then, so I wasn't really watching the news or seeing local events. So, yeah.
Although I have to admit, my very first job was like a complete fluke.
Oh, yeah? How?
I applied for it, and I had never heard about anything about it. They just called me back and had me come up, like, can you come up tomorrow? The usual story. And I'm like, sure. And I get there, and I don't know anything. I didn't even know that, you know, I didn't even know about motels, because they had booked me a motel room, but I got a motel room of my own right next door.
Nice, nice.
It was also interesting because it was like my first introduction to like 70s style sort of real culture resource management archaeology.
What do you mean by that?
Oh, well, the like this radio station, that first office was also in a home that had formerly been a pinata shop. And they're showing around the office, and they open up the fridge full of beer. And there was like a fire pit they built in the backyard that was full of old screens they were burning up.
Nice. Nice. That sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
And it was California, so we'd get back around 3 o'clock, and, like, you know, everyone would just crack open a beer. Because, like, literally the motel was, like, 3 blocks away, so it didn't matter if you cracked open a beer there at the motel.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, my my first foray into archaeology and cultural resource management archaeology was not quite the same, of course. I know. I actually didn't know anything about it. I went to a school that that didn't teach us about it necessarily. I mean, it was kind of a bullet point in an intro class, but the professors, they didn't really focus on it very much. It was more academically focused.
Wow.
I know. And then I went just because I wanted to do this, and I didn't know what it would do for me, but I did a basically kind of a field school in Africa.
Yeah.
It was a few months after I graduated college with my BA in anthropology.
Yeah.
Didn't know what I was going to do with it. Did construction with my brother and the company his father-in-law owned over the summer. Like, really didn't have any idea what I was going to do with my life. But I went to Africa, and when I came back, I was still in North Dakota with my girlfriend at the time.
Yeah.
And I was hanging around the anthropology department trying to figure out what I was going to do. And this guy shows up. Oh, actually, timeline's a little off. Before I went to Africa, I was still there.
Yeah.
And this guy shows up ahead of time. And he was living in New Orleans, and it was Hurricane Katrina. Wait. Yeah,
oh,
I think
right.
It was. I think it was Katrina.
Yeah,
yeah, one of them that went through New Orleans. It had just flooded his whole apartment and the whole office that he worked for.
Yeah.
So he had come back to North Dakota because that's where he was from.
Oh.
Just for a couple months, and while they were getting everything sorted, and he's like, "Well, have you checked the website Shovel Bums for any jobs?" And I was like, "What the heck is Shovel Bums?" And Shovel Bum, for those that you don't know, was actually a term invented by the mother of the guy who owns the Shovel Bums website.
Yeah. I don't think that's on the Wikipedia entry. I might be wrong.
Oh, I don't know. Yeah, I don't actually know. So it's interesting. But a Shovel Bum is basically a traveling field archaeologist, which we'll get into later. But so shovelbums.org or .com, I think there's both.
There is?
Yeah, I know there's a .org. Anyway.
Oh.
Shovel Bums is the website where we all find work, right? And it's one of a couple. There's ARC Fieldwork as well, archaeologyfieldwork.com. But Shovel Bums is where kind of the most people go. It's been around, I think, 20 years at this point.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, I went on there and, you know, checked it out briefly before I went to Africa. And then when I got back, I looked at it some more. And when I got back, I actually had somebody at the school there had found out a company was working on a project just across the river in East Grand Forks, Minnesota.
Oh, I know that place.
Yeah, yeah. And you know what company I'm talking about, too.
Yeah.
And so they were working over there, and they're like, they needed help. So I got in with them.
Yeah.
No per diem or anything. Just got in working an hourly job, $10 an hour they were paying me. They saw me coming because I was like, I get paid to do archaeology. And so I did that. And then after that, while I was there, I was actually looking at Shovel Bums, and I found this job in Miami. And that was the next job I went to, because I was on this job, that first job, for like 3 weeks, and then it snowed one weekend. And when it snows in late November in North Dakota, it's not going away for like, you know, 6 months. Even though it might not snow again for a little while, the snow's not going to melt because it's already super cold.
But it's also probably one of those projects where this work had to stop because of snow, because I worked in the Denial Junction, Nevada, and the snow kept going, no matter how much snow there was, unless we were about to be snowed in.
Right, right, right. So anyway, I'm going to remind people frequently throughout this show, just because we want to talk to people, call in. We do indeed. So if you're anywhere in the United States and you're listening to this on KNVC's radio station, I'm not going to put the website out there because if you're listening to this, you already know it. 775-515-4141. We are standing by to take your calls here at KNBC 95.1 FM in Carson City, Nevada. So anyway, moving on. So, yeah. You know, we have everybody has a different origin story in CRM. But let's go back a little bit and talk about cultural resource management archaeology to begin with. So there's a big difference. People don't realize it. But when you talk to somebody that doesn't know what you do and you say, oh, I'm an archaeologist, they usually say, like, what university do you work for?
Yeah.
You know, something like that. But we don't work for universities.
No.
And it's kind of disparaging a little bit, but we call it academic archaeology and professional archaeology. That's not to imply that academics aren't professionals, but it's
They're not.
That's another discussion. But it's but it does separate. It's basically people who work in the field for a living and people whose primary job is education, but they work in the field occasionally, right? I mean, I think that's the major distinction there.
Well, it's kind of like teaching about writing and actually being a writer. That's probably, like, offensive, isn't it?
That's like, you know, being a coach or being a player, right?
Yeah
kind of. No, not really. Yeah, kind of. But so anyway, cultural resource management archaeology, it's done in advance of federal funding or permitting as required by the National Historic Preservation Act, at least on federal projects. States have their own regulations.
Yeah.
People listening from California probably familiar with or at least heard of the California Environmental Quality Act, which is actually more restrictive than the federal regulations, which is okay. You can't get less restrictive because then the federal regulation takes over, but you can get more restrictive and do whatever you want, basically. So some of your first projects, were they Ruby Pipeline was one of your first ones. That was the second one. That was in Nevada.
Yeah.
But you were working in you have worked in California. What other states have you worked in?
Let's see. Well, obviously I worked in Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I worked in East Grand Forks.
There you go.
Yeah. Apparently I was you were there before they had the sushi place and Comet Pizza, the pizzeria and the REI.
I remember the REI.
Ah.
Yeah, but not the other stuff.
And let's see, I worked in Idaho.
Yeah.
Oh, I worked in Utah. I want to say I worked in Arizona, but I didn't. God, where else? Let's see, Minnesota, North Dakota.
Yeah.
I want to say Wisconsin a little. So basically the Midwest, the Plains, and the Great Basin.
Nice.
And California.
Yeah, and that's how this job works. People don't realize it, but you know, there's very few permanent jobs in this field because companies are typically relatively small and they have a principal investigator that sometimes that's also the owner. And even if you're working for a massive multi-billion-dollar corporation, chances are the archaeology department is also really small.
Yeah.
It's like a company within a company almost.
Yeah.
Right? Except a company that's always in the red, at least at the big ones. But anyway, so you've got a few people, you know, writing proposals and doing business development, or at least one person. And then you've got maybe a couple of people that are managing projects. And then you might have one or two people that are kind of like permanent field technicians just on staff to do smaller projects and things like that.
Oh, you're forgetting also the GIS dudes. They're usually permanent.
Yep. You got people doing GIS, which is geographic information systems. So mapping, things like that.
Yeah.
So they're all doing those things. And then when they get a project where they need 15 people for 3 weeks, you know, other businesses would have to be like, how are we going to hire these people to satisfy this demand?
Yeah.
But other businesses typically will expand and expand permanently.
Yeah.
You know, unless there's a huge drawdown in the economy and then they'll lay people off. But typically, if you're hiring more people, you're expanding for a reason. But in archaeology, you're expanding for a single project and then you're coming back down to the lower staffing levels. So you need the shovel bum or temporary field technician, even crew chiefs that we have in this field.
Yeah.
So it's essentially what – I mean, I've been doing this for something like 12 years now.
Yeah.
And 12, 13 years actually.
Oh,
and
10 for me.
Yeah, 10 for Richie. And I own my own company. I've been a principal investigator, project manager, crew chief. You know, Richie's done a ton of things.
Yeah.
And yet we're both basically going on this project next month, you know, essentially as shovel bums.
Oh, my God. You know, I just thought of something. So, what do you explain to people when you tell them when they ask you what you do? Because the way I say it is like I just, you know, when they go build something, I just make sure they don't ruin anything historic.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's the easiest way I found to explain it to lay people.
I mean, that's basically it. You know, we're out there to essentially protect any cultural resources that are out there. And sometimes that means physically protecting them if we're monitoring, you know, like putting up a barrier around them or making sure the bulldozers didn't come nearby.
Yeah.
Or, simply recording the data. Yeah. Sometimes you got to kind of, it's kind of necessary evils here. That's what, you're right. That's what I tell people, is that we're protecting the resources. And sometimes, like I said, protection, especially in a state like Nevada with so much material here.
Yeah.
Sometimes just recording it just means let's write everything down about it, you know, and then they can take in the, take the bulldozers in and take it down. Now, some people would disagree with that, but that's how the current regulations are.
Oh, my God. It's like those houses that UNR wanted to tear down, but they moved.
Yeah.
The one right by the freeway.
Well, similar, except we don't move archaeology sites very often.
That's true.
Unless they're structures like that.
Yeah, but have you seen that house? It's one of the houses is actually on Arlington.
Oh, really?
Yeah, near the right near Plum.
Okay. Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, my very first crew chief, when someone asked him what he did for a living, you know what he'd tell them?
What's that?
He'd tell them he was doing God's work.
Oh, my God.
Because he didn't want to talk about it.
Well, that's the thing, too, is a lot of people don't want to talk about it, which is weird, I think. Yeah. You know, I mean, I love talking about it.
Yeah.
You know, which is why I'm here on a radio show.
Yeah.
You know,
it's also why sometimes most people hear more about archaeology from like, you know, alternative sources, we'll call them, you know, like, you know, people who want to attribute everything to aliens.
Yeah. Well, that's why I think what we do and getting the stuff out on the radio and getting stuff out on podcasts, like with the Archaeology Podcast Network and the other great podcasts out there, is really education.
Yeah.
You know, and that's why Richie's down here with me now, you know, so we can talk and basically tell people what we do and why we do it, you know. And what I would love to see is a real and I've talked to TV show producers about this because if you're online at all and you have an online presence, and I do because of the, you know, podcast network and stuff like that. I actually just had I didn't tell you this yet. I was actually just approached by a producer the other day.
Yeah.
And he set up a call, so I'm going to talk to him next week.
Yeah.
But they're looking for a host. A lot of times, I think they see a picture of me, and they're like, he's got a face for radio, so maybe he knows people, though. But this guy clearly hasn't looked me up yet, but he found me somehow and said he's looking at me as a host for a TV show talking about the comparison between Kitty Hawk and the Wright brothers, and what was it, the Gustav engine, I think it's called, which was kind of an early competitor. Like, some people say that that was invented before the Wright brothers got their stuff going, and I don't really know a lot about the history, but they've got this whole show planned out, and they want somebody who has an aviation and an archaeology background, both of which I have.
Oh, yeah.
I know. It's like, how many archaeologists out there even have a pilot's certificate or have an aviation background, you know? Yeah. So I was like, I'm kind of ideally suited for this. But that being said, a lot of archaeologists would, and I've talked to ones that have, like they get these emails or calls from producers and they're like, they don't even want to talk to them because they're familiar with seeing the shows that we talk about, like Ancient Aliens and stuff like that, and people getting misrepresented. And my thought is, listen, I'm strong enough in my online persona, I think, that people understand what I'm saying, that if somebody misrepresents me, I would rather it's me on the show because I know what I'm going to say. I'd rather it's me on the show, and then people can contact me directly, because they probably will, and then say, you know, hey, you're full of crap, blah, 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 you know what. And then I can talk to them and have a good conversation.
Yeah.
Where if it's somebody else that they found to host a show that maybe doesn't have a solid background in the subject or whatever, they're just not a good representative for the industry, you know. So I do want to do it. Because you're not going to get rich and famous doing some show about the Wright brothers. You know, it's not about that.
No.
It's about getting the information out there and educating the public.
But more importantly, even if the Wright brothers weren't the first one, they were definitely the first ones to come up with a controllable plane that you could fly around. Because obviously there are people who had, like, basically gliders, effectively, is what they were, because you couldn't control them.
Well, and they were the first ones to essentially operationalize it and commercialize it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they already had a business.
Yeah. Oh, that's
saw this, you know, so. Yeah. I mean, it's weird to go from bicycles to airplanes, but, you know, whatever works for you.
Well, I mean, it's like, you know, typewriters to guns, Remington.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. Totally. So I always forget that's the same Remington.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird. It's weird.
Oh, my God. You know, and Remingtons are not the best typewriters, by the way. I can say that from experience.
Richie is definitely into typewriters. So. Hey, everybody. Chris Webster here talking about Team Black. And you can find the website at arccert.black, arccert.black. So some of you may know we've had a bunch of webinars up there and we've been doing those monthly. But just because of time constraints and because I want you to have access to those when you need access to those, I can't always do them, you know, all times throughout the day. So we set up a Patreon account, patreon.com/teamblack.
Some of the stuff is up there for free. We have the jobs video up there. Just log into the, go to the website. You don't even need an account and you can watch it. It's pretty great. And then we have several levels, four levels, I think. Five, if you can include Team Supporter, where you can join for just a month, $1 a month, and give us a little bit of money so we can keep this going. The getting started levels at $3 a month, where you can get all the stuff needed to get a job in archaeology, to get going, to get back into it. Maybe you've been out for a while. There's a bunch of great stuff there. Field technician level, $7 a month. Again, you're starting to learn about different artifact recording techniques, stuff like that. We've got a rock art 101 video up there by a world-renowned rock art expert. We've got at the crew chief level, $10 a month. Again, starting to get more into management, leadership, advanced techniques, things like that. We've got some really good stuff over there. Principal investigator, getting up to $15 a month. We've got a video there from, again, a seasoned CRM professional called Report Writing Basics. So brush up on how to write a report. It's a 50-minute long video. Watch it at your leisure. The videos are linked through Vimeo, so you can actually speed them up if you want to watch them like that. So that's pretty cool. And you go all the way up to Team Black Master, $25 a month, and you get all the stuff plus some swag. So at any one of those levels, you get those videos and the videos below them. So anytime you're ready to level up, you can just do that. Or next month, you can come back down. There's no commitments. So take a look, patreon.com/Team Black, and please share it if you love it. Back to the show.
You've worked, like you said, across the Midwest in the Great Basin.
Yeah.
I've worked in some of those areas overlapping. I've never worked in Wisconsin or Idaho, but I have worked in Utah, New Mexico, you know, Washington, Oregon, California, Nevada, North Dakota, Minnesota.
Oh, interesting. You know what's
Vermont,
interesting?
Florida.
What's interesting is that the company you work for in Utah, like, you know, some people have had good experiences with that company and some people have had bad ones.
You know, that goes to say that's probably true for almost every CRM company out there or environmental firm. Yeah. Or any business, really, quite frankly. Yeah. So, but yeah, we all have different experiences. And it's, I think when I get talking about TV, the thing I wanted to mention was what I'd love to see out there is really kind of a reality show about archaeologists. I'd love to see a full field season.
Everyone says has that idea. Everyone.
I know. And it's not unique, it just has never been done.
Well, the problem is all the confidentiality agreements.
Yeah, but it could be done.
Yeah.
It could be done without having the client or the area that you're in actually in focus. Because what I'd like to see done is actually follow a student who's finishing up their senior year of college right now. You know, because right now we're if you're listening to the recorded version of this, we happen to be in February of 2019. And so you're following a college student who's finishing up their degree right now, and they're searching for jobs, and they're figuring out what they want to do. You're following somebody who's been doing this for a few years. Yeah. You're following somebody who just recently started in a leadership position, maybe like a crew chief. And then you're also following somebody whose later career, maybe a project manager or a principal investigator. And you're following all of them, and just it's really the backstories. I don't care about the front stories. I don't care about who they're working for or what land they're working on or who the client is. I mean, you can definitely shoot video in a way that doesn't show people where you're at.
True, you know? But is there enough drama for a reality show?
Oh, you know there's enough drama for a reality show.
Yeah. I remember, what was it, Southwest Airlines had that reality show a few years ago.
Did they really?
Yeah, where, you know, it was like focusing on the gate people, the people at the gate, like the ticket agents. You know, you got to see people at their worst.
Nice. Well, I think with all the travel that we have to do and the challenges of, you know, living in a hotel room, especially if you don't know what you're doing and all that, I think it would be not only interesting, but I think it'd be entertaining. And I think it would let people know how archaeology and heritage is really done in this country. Because, well, a lot of people you talk to, they're like, oh, I always wanted to be an archaeologist, or I was always interested in archaeology. You know, they find it interesting. But then when you have something on the ballot that says, hey, we need to pay for this museum, or we need to pay for this, you know, site records repository, or we need to pay for whatever it is, they're like, do we need to? You know, I don't think I'm going to pay the extra half a penny, you know, per month to get that done.
Oh, you know, I forgot who I was talking to recently. I was talking to someone who was asking me, like, how old does it have to be, like, you know, considered eligible to be, you know, a historic resource?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I was like, 50 years. And they're like, wow, my God, that's like late. That's like, I don't know, what is 50 years ago? 69?
69, yeah.
Yeah. And they're like, my God, that seems really recent.
Yeah.
You know, but of course, that's probably an outgrowth of the way the law came about.
Yeah. And I never used to think about this, and except it's getting closer and closer. 6 more years, I'll be able to record myself.
Well, because whatchamacallit, like this building we're in, the reason, you know, the law that covers this building makes sure that you can't, like, tear it down. It's the same building that allows for, like, you know, recording of historic resources.
Exactly. Yeah. And I don't know, I can't remember if this building's on the National Register. I don't think it's on the National Register, but it's on the State Register of Historic Places.
But we have a State Register?
Yeah, almost all states do.
Oh.
Yeah. So that covers the state laws and regulations.
Yeah.
I'm not sure how that meshes if a federal permitting sort of issue had to come in here. Probably eminent domain comes into play.
Interesting.
But if it's not on the National Register, that might be more difficult. But if something's already on the State Register, there's at least probably a better chance of getting on a National Register.
Yeah.
But that's a good point to talk about next, which is what that even means. Because what we do as archaeologists, we don't just record stuff that's 50 years old.
Yeah.
I mean, we do, but what we're also doing is we're evaluating it for inclusion or eligibility for listing on the National Register of Historic Places.
Yeah.
Not the State Register. If we're on federal land, it's the National Register of Historic Places. So we don't necessarily have to nominate these places. In fact, most sites are not nominated, right?
No.
And we determine eligibility. And eligibility is determined based on 4 different factors. Was it important associated with an important person?
Yeah.
Was it associated with an important event in national history? Was it associated with a certain style of architecture or something like that?
Yeah.
Or was it a unique style of architecture, I should say, or an initial representation of that architecture? Because it could be like a Victorian house, which is not special, but is it the first Victorian house in that area?
Oh, that's true.
You know, and or was it built or designed by somebody who became a famous architect? You know, something like that.
Or is it the last of its kind?
Or is it the last of its kind? Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then the final one is data. You know, does it have a high data potential for data that we don't already have? Like if somebody finds an archaeological site buried in the ground and they start digging up part of it,
if it turns out
this is just a wealth of information and we're finding out stuff that we don't have a lot of information for, then you can list it on the National Register of Historic Places in order to protect it so we can do further research.
Yeah.
So that's what we do, essentially. You know, and a lot of people forget that. They're just like – a lot of archaeologists forget that, I think. They're just like, well, we're going to go out there and record everything 50 years old. But, you know, you ask them why and they're like, because I was told to.
Yeah.
You know, like they don't really understand.
Well, especially if it's something that's outside their interest or specialty.
Sure, sure. That's another weird thing to me is the way the education system works is in your undergrad, you kind of generalize. You know, you generalize a lot. But if you go get a graduate degree, like a master's degree, then you typically have to focus on something for your research, right?
Yeah.
And unless you went into a program like mine, which was even though I focused on a particular site that happened to be a prehistoric site, my general degree was basically in cultural resource management. So, you know, I had a lot of laws and I took environmental law classes and a bunch of other stuff to kind of help me be a better overall archaeologist.
Yeah.
And but your traditional master's program, you're going to go study something very particular, you know, very focused in maybe one site, in one area, one time period. And that you're either going to love it or hate it. And you're going to do that. You're going to focus on that, you know, probably for somewhat the rest of your career.
Well, sort of. Well, it depends if you go to academic archaeology. But if you go into CRM, you know, no one cares if you studied Mayan pottery.
Well, that's my point. You're going to focus mentally on it. But like let's say something relevant to this country, you focus on historic mining features or something like that. You know, historic mining in the late 1800s in the Virginia range, you know, that's what your focus was. So if you do that, that's great and all. But you have to understand as a CRM archaeologist or somebody in cultural resource management, you have to know everything, you know, because you might your next project. Like, honestly, we're going on this project in March and I don't even know what we're going to find. You know, my guess is a lot of prehistoric stuff because of the area. But I have no idea about the area. Like, I don't know what was there. I don't know what kind of historic stuff we could find. I know that if we're near some kind of road, there's a lot of transportation related things out there.
Yeah.
So we could find old car parts and things related to when people would break down or they had a long journey, they would often pull off in the road and have lunch and, you know, and hang out for a little while. You could find stuff like that. I don't know if there's any sort of wagon associated features. I have no idea.
Interesting.
Yeah, I have no idea. So we have to be prepared to really find anything. You know, because we don't discriminate. If it's over 50 years old, we record it. And then if it meets one of those criteria that we mentioned earlier, but it's not over 50 years old, you still record it.
You should probably mention what law those are, because obviously those are criterions A through D, but what part of the law? Which law is it part of?
So that's part of the National Historic – it's not listed in the National Historic Preservation Act.
No.
It's part of the
Was it section? Wait.
Well, section 106 is part of the National Historic Preservation Act. That is the single paragraph that says you will assess the effects or impacts of a federal undertaking on a cultural resource. Yeah. But the National Register criteria comes from the National Park Service.
Oh.
Yeah. So, because I think they run the register.
Oh.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Call in if you're an archaeologist. I did not come prepared to say that.
It is interesting, though. This is like the only state, I think, that's actually torn down a building on the historic register.
Oh, that can't be true.
Yeah, they tore down the Mapes.
I know, but there's got to be lots of ones that were torn down on the East Coast.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm just guessing. I don't even know.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, anyway, it's 12:30 almost.
Wow, really?
Yeah, I mean, I should say exactly what time it is because this is radio and all. But it's 12:28. Call in 775-515-4141. You're listening to KNVC, Carson City Community Media, 95.1 FM in Carson City, Nevada. And this is Chris Webster. I've got my guest Richie Cruz here. Yeah,
hello.
We're both archaeologists, and we're happy to take your questions about archaeology,
yeah,
or federal archaeology, contract archaeology, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Pretty much anything. So, Richie, what is one question that you get most from people who are not archaeologists?
Oh my God! What's the coolest thing you've ever found?
Yes.
And you know, I always tell people the exact same thing.
It's a T-Rex.
No. I tell them that I found a cooler full of PBR at the bottom of a Jeep trail. Literally, it was the end of the day, and we were coming down a hill.
Yeah.
Back towards the truck. And there was, like, someone went to kick over this this foam cooler top. They thought it was just, like, laying there on the ground, but it was actually covering up a cooler.
Oh, man.
And it was full of, like, at least 10-year-old PBR. It had to have been at least 10 years old. And we took it, and we drank it.
Oh, man. Did you at least cool it down first?
Well, it was in the ground. That's the reason why the cooler was cooler was buried.
Oh, okay.
That way they'd stay cold.
Nice, nice.
Because most of the other stuff, it's just like, eh.
Right, right. Yeah, it's nice to have a story like that because
I think
I might have to start saying something similar because you find money too occasionally. I found $20 bills more than a few times in the field, just like laying there.
Yeah.
I'll never forget that one time in South Carolina, we found one. It was relatively, I don't know, I'd say maybe 30, 40 feet off the road.
Yeah.
But it was a $20 bill in an area that's generally wet, either from humidity or just moisture or rain.
Yeah.
But this was like a crisp, new $20 bill with no fold in it, just like laying in a forest.
Oh, wow. Bank robbery.
I mean, we seriously like looked around for a bag of money.
Oh, my God. You know what you used to find like years ago when we both first started, but you don't find anymore?
What's that?
Porn on the side of the road.
Oh, yeah.
You know, magazines. Because, you know, the truckers would throw them out where they got home.
Wow.
But now, you know, thanks to smartphones, you know, you don't need that anymore.
Yeah, it's all digital now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's the reason I bring that up is because I knew you were going to say that.
Oh, did you?
Well, that's the question we all get, right?
Yeah.
Is what's the coolest thing you've ever found? And the thing I like to bring up to people, again, just from an educational standpoint, is it's not about the things.
No.
It's about the stories the things can tell you, right?
Yeah.
It's about the whole picture that you get. That's why I try to tell, like, for example, I met this guy this week at this business event. Actually, I think it was last week. And I introduced myself as an archaeologist that does these and this and this. And at the end, when we were just kind of mingling, he's like, he gave me his card and he's like, archaeologist, I want to talk to you. And I was like, okay, cool. And I handed him my card and he's like, I'll send you an email or something, but we've got these Greek artifacts that my grandfather brought back in the 40s or something like that.
Yeah.
And I just want to know what their value is. And I was like, oh, okay. That's what they got. I was like, first off, I don't know anything about Greece.
Yeah.
And I was like, second, you're not going to generally find an archaeologist that is going to assess value.
Yeah,
because we don't do that.
Well, more importantly, we're not the Antiques Roadshow.
We're not, right? Yeah. And there's a fine line. It's really a fine line between antiques and artifacts, right?
Yeah.
I mean, most of that stuff on the Antiques Roadshow, if it were found on an archaeological site or within a historic resource that you're recording, it now becomes an artifact, and you're not going to own it. It's going to go to a museum. It's going to go to some kind of repository. People are going to learn from it.
Well, the easiest way I think about it is that, you know, artifacts themselves, the actual objects, are more the province of like historians.
Mm-hmm.
We are actually interested in the sites, which is why we are always pissed off when people take artifacts, because without artifacts, there is no site unless there are features.
Right, and that's what I was talking about.
Yeah.
So we look at the whole picture.
Yeah.
The artifacts that are there, even the broken pieces of artifacts and the whole artifacts and things like that, they all go to help tell that story. And when you remove something from one of those sites, especially the fun, pretty stuff, which probably tells us more information, then that's less that we can tell about the whole picture of the area. So it's really damaging to the site.
Oh, my God. You know what's cool? The 3D, I mean, you know, speaking of artifacts and stuff, or as I like to call it, junk.
Yeah.
You know, the 3D printing technology is getting so good that they almost produce like arrowheads. They're almost as good as like, you know, if you've actually flint-net them yourself.
Yeah, they can.
Yeah.
They can. Yeah. We've got one where my office is that can kind of do that sort of quality.
Yeah.
You know?
And it's like, you know, and yet people still want to collect these little bits of junk for like no reason. They're just going to end up in a shoebox underneath like, you know, underneath like someone's bed.
Yeah. And, you know, the one thing is, I mean, I probably get raked over the coals by other archaeologists for saying this, but I almost respect people more for just wanting to find this stuff and sell it, because at least they're doing it for a reason, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, they want to know what the value is. They're going to put it on some eBay. I'm not saying sell artifacts, but at least that's some kind of reason. The people that go out and pick this stuff up and then put it in their house in some sort of box on the wall or in a jar on their mantle or something like that, that does nothing for anyone.
Yeah.
You know, it's not out in the system anymore, and it's no longer visible. Nobody knows where it came from. And the context, which is the most important thing, is now completely gone.
Yeah.
So, you know, that's – we could sit here and talk about laws and stuff all day, because if you're picking this stuff up off of federal land, it's illegal. You could go to jail and you could get fined.
Yeah.
You know, there have been people in the past, especially out here in the West, that have been raided by the FBI. And if they're like career, you know, pot hunters, we call them.
Yeah.
And they're out there finding all this stuff. And I've heard, I mean, you always hear more than a few stories where people have committed suicide, older people, because their entire life is about to be ruined, because I think they kind of knew what they were doing was wrong.
Yeah.
You know, and then this FBI raid happens. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're facing 30 years of jail time for accumulated sentences.
Well, the thing that always gets me interested is the fact that people who do the looting, like, say that they're doing it because they want to, like, you know, become closer to people, you know, closer to history. But it's like, why would the object bring you closer to history than, like, the place?
Yeah, yeah. It's like, spend some time in the location
and
try to think what it was like at the time period it was used.
Yeah, like, you know, what's more interesting, going to Gettysburg or finding a little lead bullet?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, that being said, I mean, the artifacts do kind of connect you a little bit, you know, when you actually get to see, this is why museums exist.
Yeah.
You know, museums, and this is another reason why I have an issue with museums, right? I think a lot of this stuff should just be virtual. That way you can take, you know, you can go to take a 3D tour of your museum, but the museum can take the artifacts they have, 3D scan them, and put them in context, right? Because it's cheaper to do that than it would be to make like a whole diorama, which is some of the most interesting things at museums are the big, full-scale, life-size, you know, things with artifacts in context with people using them, right?
Yeah.
Those are the most interesting things, and those are the things people focus on. But a lot of museums, they just have glass cases full of things. And because they're in glass cases, because they're hidden behind those glass cases, we then assess value to them. Yeah. And then so now this thing becomes valuable, even if it's valuable from a they have it and I don't standpoint, even if it's not monetary. Now when somebody sees something similar out in the field, they're out hiking, they're out you know, hunting, doing whatever – they want to pick it up because they saw it as something valuable, even though it might not have any actual monetary value.
See,
like if you find an Elko projectile point, good luck selling that. You know, there's literally thousands of them.
I know.
So,
you know, it's interesting. I mean, not to get too philosophical, but I remember a story years ago, this garbage man was like going around making his rounds and he picks up this little leather bag and he opens it. And there is like one of the first, like literally he's looking, there was an old camera in it, a Nikon. And then, you know, he's looking at the serial number because he was like a Nikon collector. And it was like one of the first Nikons ever made. So he goes up to the door of the lady, you know, whose garbage can it is. And he's like, you know, this is really valuable. You probably shouldn't be throwing out. And she takes the bag. She goes up to her garbage can, forcibly throws it back in.
Wow.
Yeah. So he takes it and he auctions it off for like a 6-digit figure. You know, which all shows that value is relative, and so is artifact, you know, significance relatively. Not to get too philosophical.
No, but you're right. You know, people who are closer to the object are going to place more value on it.
Yeah.
You know, that's why in communities where Native Americans are really, really involved in the community.
Yeah.
You know, and really involved, they place. Obviously, inherently, for Native American artifacts, they place a lot more value on it because it's their ancestors, right? But in areas where they're especially more involved, you know, there's just that they're really connected to it.
Yeah.
They're really connected to it. And you have to place it. But that's not just Native Americans either.
Yeah.
There's historical artifacts and sites going back 400 years in this country from all sorts of ethnicities.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I mean, oh my God. It's like the mid-century modern group we're both a part of. Like some people look at those buildings. They're like, oh my God, it's so beautiful. They ought to be preserved. The other people are like, man, those are ugly as, you know, those are ugly as S. You know, we should tear them down.
Right.
Yeah. Or alternatively, I was actually talking to an archaeologist about this. He's like, man, you know, if you start messing around with the 50-year cutoff, you know, you start like, you know, that means like early space race stuff isn't preserved. Or like, you know, or like the test range where they did like, you know, where, whatchamacallit, did the first like, you know, hypersonic or supersonic like, you know, flights took place.
Right.
You know, and stuff like that.
Yeah.
You know, is that worthy of preserving or not?
Yeah, it just depends, because when you look at going back to the National Register criteria, important events to national history.
Yeah.
And important events to national history are things like, you know, if you could preserve, that's a good question with like the first jet sonic breaking the sound barrier, like Chuck Yeager.
Yeah.
You know.
Oh, that's what I was thinking of.
Yeah. So Glamorous Glennis, the plane that he did it, is in the Smithsonian.
Yeah.
It's in the Air and Space Museum. I just saw it. Last fall.
Ah.
So, or when was that? Yeah, somewhere. But so that plane is in the Air and Space Museum, but the airport's not.
Oh, it's not?
You know? No, I don't think so. Wasn't it Edwards Air Force Base or near there? Or was it Edwards?
Or was it one of the dry lakes in Southern California?
Yeah, I can't remember. I think it was an Air Force Base.
Yeah.
But either way, those kinds of things from the military, they don't preserve bases like that.
They should.
They should. And sometimes that stuff ends up getting preserved because of where it's at. For example, I went to boot camp in San Diego, California, and that particular recruit training command for the Navy was closed down about 4 months after I went there.
Oh.
They were in the process of closing it down. I just happened to be one of the last companies to go through there.
Yeah.
So now when I went down there actually after you and I were finishing a project in El Centro, California about 4 years ago. I went down there to San Diego to meet a couple more people that were going to be working on the project. Yeah. I don't know if you went with us on that. We went to dinner there, actually. We went to dinner on the base where I went to boot camp.
Oh, no, then I was not there.
Okay, yeah. So because the base now has been sold, and there's still some areas that are used by the military, but most of the base has been sold to development, and they've preserved some of the buildings.
Yeah.
They've preserved some of the things, but now it's like there's housing there. It's kind of like a hipster shopping center with like restaurants and stuff like that. And that was the base I was on, so not all of it was preserved.
Oh my God, that's like Mountain View. There's actually like the largest wooden structure I think still in existence is there.
Right.
It's what was it? It's the hangar that they used for the dirigibles.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is super cool.
Which is where the word hangar comes from.
Oh.
They used to hang balloons in there.
I didn't know that.
And like Zeppelins.
Oh wow. And I might be wrong, but I think it was in the J.J. Abrams movie.
Oh yeah,
yeah. Where they're like in the they're in their hangar, like getting on shuttles and stuff.
Nice.
Yeah, I think that's that hangar.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ha. Well, anyway, history. Yeah. It's always fun. We like talking about it.
Hey everybody, Chris Webster here to talk about WildNote. WildNoteApp.com. So if you're on the system, check it out. Archaeology, environmental, everything. If you've got a company that does all those different verticals, then please check out WildNoteApp.com. It's your one-stop solution. You might be using Survey123, Collector, things like that. They have their limitations. WildNote can do a lot of things that those can't do, and it can do it for your entire company. So again, WildNoteApp.com to replace all those other things. Hey, Chris, back again to talk about membership at the Archaeology Podcast Network, archpodnet.com/members. It's not cheap or easy to put all this on for you guys for free. So for those of you that want to step up and support at $5, $10, $20 a month or 30% off that if you get that for a year, check it out plus extras at archpodnet.com/members. Now back to the show.
What's one thing we don't do, Richie?
What
do we don't do that we always get a question about?
Oh, have we found Atlantis yet?
No. Dinosaurs.
Oh, that's
what I'm talking about. That's what I'm talking about. So we often get the question,
have
you found anything, you know, any dinosaur bones or anything like that? It's another thing I want to make sure. I should probably just put it in the introduction for this show.
Oh, you should.
Yeah, because archaeologists don't do dinosaurs. That's what we always say. Because people confuse, and it's understandable, you know, if you're not part of the system, but people confuse archaeology with paleontology.
Yeah.
Paleontology is paleo is old, basically the study of old fossilized things, yeah. Which can be human related because paleoanthropology studies the origins of humankind, right?
Yeah, but they didn't exist at the same time as dinosaurs.
Definitely not. At most, people were starting to look human and diverging from apes.
Yeah.
I mean, it varies, but 3 to 7 or 8 million years ago.
That's true.
Yeah. Now, you can look at a long line of – this isn't a paleoanthropology podcast or radio show, but it's turning into that. You can look at a long line of descent because there wasn't one time when you had an ape that had a human child. Ah. It didn't happen that way. So it's kind of fluid on where you look at how far back are we going and calling this, you know, the human line. I mean, you can go all the way back to the first single-celled organism as part of the human ancestral line.
Yeah.
Because we all descended from the same thing, right?
That's true. So, and that was only 6,000 years ago, right?
Oh, well, that's, again, another topic. Something I like to think about while we're talking about human origins and evolution is that anybody listening to this right now is from a long line of successful progenitors. You're from a long line. You might be the last in your line. Probably. I might be the last in my line. I don't know. But, you know, if you're alive right now or anybody you've ever met, they are the end at that point in time of a successful line of evolution and breeding, going all the way back to the first single-celled organisms or whatever started life on this planet.
Wow.
Isn't that amazing to think about?
Yeah. And now we are here, you know, with, you know, our president and everything.
I'm not saying we haven't regressed in evolution just a little bit. But anyway, I'll say this one more time because we've got about 15, 16 minutes to go here. But call in with your questions, 775-515-4141. Send me an email, chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Let me know that you're listening. I want to try to gauge what kind of audience we have here. Yeah. You can send in a tweet, as I said before, Archaeowebby, ArchEowebby, and ArcPodNet is the Archaeology Podcast Network. I can check both of those, ArchPodNet. So,
wait, before we go on, can I just say this is just like, you know, what I always imagined college radio to be? Like, literally.
It's very similar, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's cool.
Yeah, it's not bad.
I almost feel like we should have brought some records.
I know. Well, there are records here, so.
You know what the craziest part is about working in that bookstore was?
Hmm.
Let's see, Dale Carnegie. I forget what the, like, How to Win Friends or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
They actually have a record version of that.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Record audiobook. I like it.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so back to dinosaurs real quick. Paleontology, basically the study of dinosaurs.
Yeah.
Dinosaurs died out, we always like to say 65 million years ago, but that's actually a little bit fluid.
Yeah.
It was probably a little bit later than that. Not everything went away simultaneously. But that being said, especially considering the fact that birds are evolved from dinosaurs, so something survived. Right. Yeah. So, So I guess humans did coexist with dinosaurs because there were birds, right? Yeah.
That's true.
Anyway, so human archaeology, A-R-C-H-E-O or A-E-O, depending on who you're talking to, is Latin, or I'm sorry, Greek for human. Ah. So study of humans is archaeology. So anything human related, no matter how far back, is archaeology, right? As long as humans were involved, they were involved in the creation or use or reuse of a site, then that's archaeology.
Yeah.
Archaeology is a subfield of anthropology in this country, and other places it's kind of its own department.
Oh, it is?
Yeah, like in England, I think archaeology is more of a hard science than it is part of the anthropology, which is more of philosophy or social science. So anthro is Latin for human, and it's the study of humans is anthropology. So the four-field approach, they call it, is basically under anthropology, archaeology, bioanthropology, which is basically the study of the physical processes of bones and things like that. And then...
Wait, you mean physical anthropology?
Yeah, physical anthropology. Well, bioanthropology or physical anthropology. I've seen it both ways. And then cultural anthropology, which is the study of, you know, all of our cultural things that we do, from how we use things to how we see things to music that we create.
So basically fancy sociology.
Basically, yeah. And then linguistics. Linguistics is also part of that four-field approach. So,
my God, they're actually at the bookstore when I was working there, there's actually someone who just graduated with a master's degree in linguistics.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Which is a weird thing to have a degree in just linguistics. You'd think you'd focus on a language. But I guess you can study linguistics from the standpoint of basically linguistical archaeology, where you're going through and you're saying, well, these word origins, how do these have a, you know, how do these have a mix, you know, going back.
It is interesting, though, how most of us ended up in, you know, going for anthropology, and then you end up in CRM archaeology because you need an actual job.
Right. Well, and this actually brings up something, as far as linguistics goes, it brings up something that's interesting to me about all the fields of, under anthropology.
Yeah.
So all four of them is we do all kind of do the same thing. And when you take all four of these field approaches and you bring them into a same story, you can really tell a lot about somebody, you know, you somebody who lived hundreds or thousands of years ago.
Yeah.
Because if you take linguistics, you can take language and you can start working that back and find out where do these common, or where does the language split off? Where do things start to change? So you can pick a time frame there.
Yeah.
You can do the same thing with physical attributes. If there's been enough change there, you can say, how have these genes propagated through the system? You know, looking at DNA, stuff like that.
Oh, I thought you were about to say talking about the landscape.
Well, I'm getting there. Oh, yeah. Right. So you can do the same thing from a cultural standpoint, looking at stories.
Yeah.
You know, where do these two cultures have similarities in their stories? Does that mean they split off at some point?
Yeah.
Back in the past, you can start looking at that. That adds a little bit more to the timeline. And then archaeology starts looking at the actual sites and locations and all the artifacts there and the landscape associated with it. So, you know, you take all these factors together. People are like, how do archaeologists know that this is true? How do they know? Because it's not just archaeology. It's relative dating, we call it, or sort of like relational dating. So we'll take all these different sources and we got, okay, so this dates from here to here. This dates from here to here. This dates from here to here. Where does all this overlap?
Yeah.
Now we know how long ago it was, and we have a lot more pieces to the puzzle.
You know, it's interesting. If people are like interested, if more interested in this subject, I can always recommend Kevin Fagan's books. Brian Fagan.
Yeah.
Oh, I knew it was something like that.
Yeah. No, he's a researcher. Where's he at? Down in San Diego or LA somewhere?
No, he retired.
But he was.
Yeah, he was at UC Santa Barbara, I think. No, wait. Or was he at one of the Cal Polys?
Yeah. Well, either way, he's writing a lot of really popular books on, like, really easy to read books on.
Yeah, that's why I suggested it.
Yeah, it's basically on anthropology because it's kind of the full study.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you ever wanted to like, what was it? He wrote that book in California, had to study.
I think it's called Before California.
Yeah, which is like a very fluffy. Well, I thought it was fluffy.
It's a little fluffy, but that's what you need that, you know, because you don't want an academic text to sit there and read sometimes.
Oh, I know.
But I like the way he starts that book because I'm pretty sure that's the book where each chapter starts with
a little
kind
vignette.
Of like a story.
Yeah.
Yeah. Like he goes back in time
to
a certain time period and imagines what a scenario would be like.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. For whatever he's about to talk about.
Yeah.
Which was really cool, I thought. So, yeah. Well, coming up to the end here. So, Richie, what is I was going to ask you. What is a place that you haven't worked that you would really like to work? Is there anything that you would just like, if you could just go anywhere and do anything, even from an academic standpoint, let's look at the whole planet. Where's something that you would like to eventually do some work at? Not just visit, but actually do some more research on.
Honestly, I am really bored by most other archaeology outside of the Great Basin. Like, that's the thing. Like, I didn't realize when I went to field school that I was like, that was the great part, the western edge of the Great Basin.
Yeah.
And I really started to like it. And when I first got this job in, you know, the Ruby Pipeline, I'm like, I don't want to go to Nevada. And then I got here and it's like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
It's like just basically just like where I was.
Right.
So I am definitely a Great Basin archaeologist.
Nice.
And I'm not that interested. Yeah. I can't help it. I really like this old mining stuff.
It's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting what the Great Basin's done to me because when I was in college, this is why I went to Africa for my field school.
Yeah.
I was always really more interested in going back as far back as we can and learning the answers to the first questions.
Really?
That's what I wanted to know. Yeah.
Oh.
And that's why I never took the field school that my school offered. It was a historic site from, I want to say, the 1800s in North Dakota.
Oh, that would have been cool.
Now I think it would have been cool, right? But at the time, I was like, I need to go farther back. But now, as I've come to the Great Basin, because I also think mining stuff is actually really cool.
Yeah.
I mean, this stuff is sometimes like less than 100 years old.
Yeah.
But it's really neat because when you can get onto an archaeology site and see maybe six artifacts and then practically place the year that this site was actually used. You know, because a lot of these mining sites, they were only used for a very short period of time unless they were successful.
Which is very uncommon.
Very uncommon, yeah. So, I mean, I think that's why gambling got popular here in Nevada because people are already used to gambling, you know, with trying to find, you know, ore deposits and whatever they were looking for.
You know, it's like that mining book that you suggested to me years ago, the one that's out of print.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
God, I forget
the name. Riches to Rust?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, that was like, you know, God, I loved reading that. I literally read that in like an afternoon.
Yeah, check out Riches to Rust. I think it's the last name is Twitty, the guy that wrote it. Yeah, something like that. But Riches to Rust is the name of the book. So. Yeah. It's really great, especially for people who want to who go out into the Nevada countryside and you see these old mining sites.
Yeah.
He's got tables in the back of this book that are like, hey, if you see this thing and it measures this by this and it's got screw hole pattern that looks like this, it was this.
Yeah.
You know, and you could tell exactly what it was. Yeah. You know, don't take anything off the site and don't dig anything on the site. Just appreciate it for what it is and let other people appreciate it. But it's a really cool write up on historic mining and hard rock mining and and all the stuff associated with it.
And I think it's interesting that I like read that, you know, after I graduated, because like a lot of the books I read when I was like, you know, going through undergrad and grad were like, my God, I just want to like roll my eyes back. Like, who is it that you don't like? Was it Bruce Trigger?
Oh, my God. It's not that I don't like the Trigger book, but it's just that theory gets so mind-numbingly boring sometimes.
Yeah, it's like, you know, if they intersperse stuff like, you know, like Riches to Rust, you know, people might stick with it more.
I know. Well, that goes back to our educational system, which, again, is another topic entirely.
Yeah.
So I think one of the things that I would do if money and time and, you know, permitting were no were no object, I still like to know the origins of things. But now, while I would jump at the chance to go do paleoanthropology in Africa again, I just – if I won the lottery – I would try to fund a field school out there and just say, let me work with you guys. Like, I'll put real people who have studied that stuff on it, and I'll pay for them to be there. But I just want to be there as well. You know, I'm not going to be like – I just want to work. I just want to be there while they're discovering things and help along, because I really love that stuff.
Oh,
I really love filling in those pictures.
Wait, I did just think of something. Like, in the far future, once all the radioactivity has gone away, it'd be cool to look around Chernobyl or whatever town that is. You know? Yeah. Like, look at that little time capsule.
That would be pretty interesting, I think. Yeah.
Especially as someone who really enjoys watching, not necessarily playing the Metro games.
Well, just towns like Chernobyl. I mean, I've seen video and stuff of that. There's been a lot of things produced about that place.
Yeah.
I mean, just everybody up and left.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like a time capsule for...
Which is nice. What makes it cool.
I know. It makes it really cool.
And that's, you know, and that's the thing. Like, if people went in there and just took away all the artifacts, it wouldn't be cool anymore. And that's, you know, why archaeologists get mad when you loot sites.
I know. So, luckily, it's still highly radioactive. And then people can't go in there yet.
Yeah.
So.
You know, it's interesting. You know, in America, like, you know, you have similar situations. Not the radioactivity, but the time capsule quality on most of these bases.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where does Alan, like, take those tours?
Oh, it's China Lake Naval Weapons Center.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where I worked right after we worked in El Centro.
Yeah, like, I know my buddy said he, like, found intact baskets, you know, there and stuff like that. You know, but think about, you know, if someone had taken that home, of course, it's going to turn to dust, you know, and stuff. But, it, like, wouldn't be as cool.
Yeah, so that whole area, it's 1.1 million acres in the eastern Mojave near Ridgecrest, California. And the Navy took that whole area over back in the 40s, mid-40s, I think it was. And I think it was right after World War II, or as that was wrapping up, they took that place over really as a weapons testing area. So they could basically fire weapons off in the middle of nowhere and nobody cares. Except some people care because we're living there. So there's these homesteads that we recorded.
Oh, that there were?
Oh, yeah. We recorded a few homesteads right near Ridgecrest that nobody's ever recorded before. And it's just like people up and took off.
Neat.
You know? Now, there's craters there. The houses are gone because they were early targets for the military before they knew what they were doing, right?
Yeah.
So it's not like they're in perfect condition, but there are a lot of things there. Like with one of these sites, we spent 3 days recording it, you know, and had what we call diagnostic artifacts. So anything that gives you a date, basically, or information about the manufacturer. That's a diagnostic artifact, and we had hundreds of them. I mean, hundreds. It was ridiculous. So anyway, the point that Richie's making here is some of these military installations that have all this land basically blocks off the public from going there.
Yeah.
And if they did it early enough to, you know, obviously pre-internet, pre-seeing monetary value in this kind of stuff, that's not to say ranchers didn't pick up Native American artifacts and stuff like that, because it was kind of cool to see that land on the ground, and then they'd pick it up and take it home. But... You know, as more people came to these areas and things actually had started having a monetary value and you could sell it around the world, now people pick that stuff up all the time. So when they were blocked off in the 40s and 50s because of military installations, it really was, a way to preserve it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yay.
I know. Another preservation technique I heard of, where was I? Might have been grad school or might have been well before that. It all kind of blends together now. But on the East Coast, there's a lot of digging that gets done because of the way the geology works. Here in the West, at least in the high desert, not necessarily California, but at least in the high desert, we just do survey because there's very little soil creation, right? So things are just sitting on the surface, and they have been for 10, 15,000 years or more.
Yeah.
So we have that, but out in the East, there's a lot of sand and things like that, and stuff is created, and so you have to dig. Well, one of the ways to preserve a deep site, like if you dig way down, maybe you're auger testing, you get down a couple meters or something, one of the ways to preserve a deep site is to actually build over the top of it.
Yeah. Oh, because, I was gonna say that.
Yeah, because it means we can't get to it, but we can at least dig it. We can at least put a huge cement slab over the top of it. Now, the trick is... is anybody going to know that site is there in 50 years when we take that cement slab back out? You know,
it depends.
Hopefully they do. Chances are something else is going to go in there. But if they decide to put a tall building right there, then they're probably going to dig through the site.
Well, that's the way they mitigated the oldest archaeological site in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Yeah?
Yeah, it's actually a mall. Yeah. You know, it's a mall, and it used to be a shell mound that they think dates back 10,000 years, so before the bay even filled in when it was still a valley.
That is insane.
Yeah, and like, you know, like, so, and they left a lot of the bodies in there, too, because it was a very toxic site. Ironically, it was a paint factory that produced Indian Red.
Wow.
Yeah, for years.
Yeah. Okay, then.
Yeah.
So, anyway, we're nearing the end of the show here. I want to thank Richie for joining me down here in Carson City. I was kind of worried about how the drive was going to be down here from Reno because of all the snow we had yesterday. But it was nice and good. So come on down to Carson. It's not too bad.
Although it did ruin my drinking. I was going to go out drinking and then it was like snowing. I'm like, nah.
Very nice. Very nice. So, all right. Well, we've got a couple more. Just so everybody knows, I've got a really great show next week with somebody who is from the Institute for Canine Forensics over in California, and they use dogs to find basically cremains, which are human remains that have been cremated. So we call them cremains. And there are people in the fires that obviously burned up in the fire, so they're looking for them.
Oh.
But there were also lots of people who had cremains. I know one family had like five, I think, in an article I read, because it's like both their parents and like a child or something, and they were all sitting on the mantle, and they didn't have time to grab them during the last big fire, the campfire.
All right.
And the dogs went and helped find those. And so they did that. So we're going to have one of them on. I've talked to this woman before. Her name is Lynn.
Yeah.
Really great, really interesting. So we're going to have her on. And then I think on the following week, I'm going to be at the Society for California Archaeology, so we're going to have another show here in its place, and then the week after that, I've got the new president of the Society for California Archaeology, Michelle Cross. She was actually supposed to be today, but there was a scheduling conflict.
Oh, so that was today.
That was today, yeah. Oh. So, and I think it's later on in March now, and then when Richie and I go on this project, I'll have a few other episodes brought in from the Archaeology Podcast Network that I'm going to play on this radio show while we're doing that. So I want to thank Richie for coming in, and thank everybody for listening. You can always contact me, Chris, at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com, at Archaeowebby, ArchEowebby, or ArchPodNet, ArchPodNet. Those handles also work on Instagram. They work on Twitter. On Facebook, we're facebook.com/ArchPodNet. And you can find Richie and I at that channel. Like the page so you get a notification when we go live and you can interact with us, answer questions. We call that show You Call This Archaeology because we talk about all kinds of different things that are essentially possibly not related to archaeology but end up being related to archaeology. So... again, join us for those, and thank you, and we want to take your calls. This is a call-in show, so...
We do?
We do. We actually do want to take your calls. You know, we both do podcasts, and we don't get a chance to interact with people, so we want to do calls. We want to take in calls, so please call in next time. I'll give you the phone number for next time. Write it down, 775-515-4141, and we will see you next week. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Archaeology Podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. You can provide feedback using the contact button on the right side of the website at www.archaeologypodcastnetwork.com/archaeology. Or you can email Chris at archaeologypodcastnetwork.com. Please like and share the show wherever you saw it so more people can have a chance to listen and learn. Send us show suggestions and follow ArcPodNet on Twitter and Instagram. This show is produced by the Archaeology Podcast Network. Opinions are solely those of the hosts and guests of the show. However, the APN stands by their hosts. Special thanks to the band Sea Hero for letting us use their song I Wish You'd Look. Check out their albums on Bandcamp at seahero.bandcamp.com. Check out our next episode in 2 weeks, and in the meantime, keep learning. Keep discovering new things, and keep listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network. Have an awesome day. This show is produced and recorded by the Archaeology Podcast Network, Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle, in Reno, Nevada, at the Reno Collective.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.
Thanks again for listening to this episode and for supporting the Archaeology Podcast Network. If you want these shows to keep going, consider becoming a member for just $7.99 US dollars a month. That's cheaper than a venti quad eggnog latte. Go to archpodnet.com/members for more info.